Every year, tens of thousands of dogs, mostly beagles, are used as tools in deadly research experiments. Join me, your host, Ellie Hansen, as we dive into this issue and talk to all the awesome people out there trying to make a difference for these dogs. Best of all, find out what you can do to help. We're opening doors for discussion and shedding light on the facts. This is Dog Research Exposed. Imagine having a dream of becoming a neuroscientist. Neuroscience, which examines the structure and function of the human brain and nervous system, is extremely important in our human world today to find causes and treatments for diseases such as autism, depression, ADHD, addiction, Parkinson's disease, and epilepsy, just to name a few. I'll bet each one of us knows someone who has one of these disorders. This is why many scientists choose this profession, to find cures, to help people. But what if you reached the end of your schooling and discovered that in order to become a research scientist, you must hurt and kill animals? What if you were instructed to conduct outdated animal experiments? What would you do? Dr. Emily Trunnell joins us in this episode to shine a light on how we can modernize research and look toward a future without harming dogs and other animals for this purpose. She currently works for PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and she has a PhD in neuroscience. While Dr. Trunnell previously performed experiments on animals in her profession, she now works with government agencies and other scientists to replace the use of animals with superior research methods. In my opinion, science should be visionary. It should be ready to evolve with the times and shift gears. Dr. Trunnell is a visionary, and I hope we can all aspire to become visionaries as we listen to this enlightening episode of Dog Research Exposed. So your early work career, earning your PhD in neuroscience, was on the track of using animals for experimental research, and you were so disillusioned by that. Can you give us some examples of experiences in your work as a researcher that were the final straw, that you simply couldn't continue, and that inspired you to work for PETA instead?
For me, it was kind of a slow process. I know some people talk about having a light bulb moment, but for me, well, you know, I started out and I thought, you know, I was presented with, this is what I would be doing. I would be using animals in experiments because that's what the lab that I wanted to join did, and because I was told that journals didn't want to publish papers on just cells. They wanted to see things done in an animal, and you know, that's how you get ahead in science, is you to publish papers. And so at first I thought, you know, well, this is for a good cause. This is for science, and it'll just be a few animals that are used. I wasn't really aware of how many animals are used or what the process was like or what would happen to them. But it accumulated for me over the course of my PhD, and I guess the final straw for me was really some of the last set of experiments that I did before I graduated. I was doing studies looking at the effect of diet on learning and memory in mice and rats. And until the very last year of my graduate training, none of the experiments I did, although the animals were all killed at the end, none of them were particularly aversive. Other than, you know, having to be in a laboratory environment. But the last experiment I did, I injected rats with something that caused them to feel sick. And I did that as part of a memory experiment. And it was extremely upsetting to me. The substance that we were injecting was painful to them, just directly painful, and then knowing that I was going home that day and they would spend the rest of their night alone in a cage feeling sick. And rats can't vomit, so they just have to feel this, you know, terrible feeling. It filled me with such anxiety. I just remember getting migraines, and I at that time I didn't really understand why I was feeling like this, because this is just what I did. But I would get migraines at the end of the day and just felt just generally very stressed and awful. So having to do that, and then another part, a big part of it for me, was sitting down to write my dissertation at the end of my PhD and having to, you know, you do the experiments and then afterward you kind of fill in the why, which that's how it was for me anyway. And having to, you know, go through the literature and justify the experiments and realizing that I really did this all just to graduate. There was no higher purpose for the experiments. It was just, Emily needs experiments to graduate. And then counting, you know, the number of animals that had suffered and died for that, you know, that didn't weigh out to me as far as a harm-benefit analysis. So that was kind of my trajectory and how I felt at the end.
You touched on this topic just briefly a moment ago. I understand that there is a certain degree of lasting trauma associated with experimenting on animals. I've read several articles that point to this fact, and you've written that you still experience a dull ache in your stomach thinking back to your time in the research laboratory. You felt strongly enough to leave this line of work for something you knew was kinder and better. Many people don't. What frame of mind would someone have to put themselves in to keep working in this laboratory environment? And what toll do you think this takes on a person's personal life and emotional life?
So I think the frame of mind, the specifics might be different for different people, but I think overall it all involves dissociation. So dissociating yourself from, you're either having to forget that the animals that you're using are sentient and you view them, have to train yourself to view them as laboratory equipment, or you have to make yourself believe that the science that you're doing is worth the harm, and which means you have to ignore all the evidence that says it doesn't. But you really have to dissociate from those innate feelings. I mean, you think about how children see animals and how we all see animals until something happens and we're told, oh no, you must view these animals this way and other animals a different way. So, you know, really compartmentalizing those feelings and pushing them down and kind of telling yourself a different kind of truth every day to justify what you're doing. Because, you know, none of us wants to think about ourselves as doing something awful. You know, we want to think about ourselves as good people. I think personally, it can be alienating from, you may feel alienated from friends or family that you have in other professions. I remember before graduate school, I worked in the restaurant industry in a bit, and I had several friends from that era. And I went to grab a glass of wine with a friend after being in the lab all day one day. And she was asking me about what I did, and she knew a little bit, but she didn't know that, you know, I was using rats. And so she was like, well, what happens to the rats at the end of the experiment? You know, do they get to be rehomed? And I'm like, no, well, we kill them because we need the brain tissue to analyze for the data. And just the look on her face, she was horrified. And it was so normalized to me at that point, I was really surprised. So I think for people, you know, it can feel alienating. It can lead people to not have an outlet to talk about what they do, and just trying to extend some compassion. Anyone not having an outlet to discuss something stressful that's happening in their lives can, you know, that's can lead to bad mental health outcomes. And, you know, you may abandon friendships from earlier times in life and kind of create an echo chamber where you just associate with other people who are doing animal experiments. And even if you want to talk about what you're experiencing, if you are experiencing negative emotions and feelings like that, that there's sort of a, you're dissuaded from talking about them because that may give the animal rights side or people who oppose animal experiments ammunition against what you're doing. And that's kind of really, that comes across that you're not supposed to talk about those things. So
this is a podcast that focuses on dogs and research, but I'm personally very interested in rats. I believe you wrote somewhere that you formed emotional bonds to certain rats in the laboratory. I don't know that people understand the value of rats, that rats do have feelings. Could you explain that just a bit?
Sure, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I'd never met a rat in real life, or, you know, maybe seen mice in the yard or something before. But almost everyone's knows dogs. So it's much easier to empathize with dogs and, you know, even primates who we view as having similar cognitive abilities. But I was really surprised how much personality rats have. If you're not breeding the animals in the laboratory, you order them from a vendor and they arrive at the facility and you typically spend a week acclimating them to the facility. That involves acclimating them to handling. That was the best part of any experiment. You just get to go in and hold the rats and just say, hey, you know, you can trust me, which they couldn't, obviously. That would have, we broke those promises. But, you know, some of them would just, they would just sit there and nuzzle your arm. Some of them were very curious and wanting to sniff and explore you. And they all had different personalities. There were some that absolutely hated me. Anytime I tried to pull one out of a cage, they would just dart and run, and then some would come right up to you. So I maintained a dissociation from them in that we didn't name them. They were just had numbers. And so I didn't have a particular rat that one individual who I connected with, but what I connected with is just their, just how smart they are and curious and how much they deserve just as much to be loved and respected just as much as a dog does, because they, that's who they are. Just because they're a rat doesn't make them lesser than. So I have a fondness for them for sure.
You've recently written the afterword for the book Free the Animals by Ingrid Newkirk, who is the founder and president of PETA. In your afterword, you specifically identify facilities that are still doing animal experiments today, some of which seem very similar to those that were done 30 years ago. 30 years ago is a long time in my mind, and we didn't even have the high-tech computers we have today or cell phones back then, and now we have all this amazing technology. So why are scientists still repeating the same experiments over and over again? And can you give us some examples of experiments that should be stopped immediately because they simply are not necessary anymore?
The experiments are still happening for several reasons. So a big one, you know, what makes the world go round? It's money. When researchers get grants from the federal government, the universities can take sometimes half of that money. And these are each, you know, $400,000 grants in some cases, sometimes much more and sometimes a little bit less. But hundreds of thousands of dollars the university can just take to do whatever they want with. They can pay payroll, they can build new facilities. So there's a big incentive for, if you're a researcher at university, from your administration to publish papers and get grants with very little regard to what you're actually doing in those experiments, as long as you keep the money coming in. And then also in the realm of money, there is a giant industry that profits off of breeding and selling animals to be used in research, so primates, dogs, pigs, mice and rats, all the most commonly used animals. All the tools that are used in the experiments can be incredibly expensive. So tools for the surgeries and for monitoring and euthanasia equipment. So there's an industry that creates all of those things, and that they're some of the biggest donors to pro-animal experimentation lobby groups. So in addition to money, there's also just the inertia. So, you know, like you mentioned, 30 years ago, we didn't really have good computers. You know, some of these scientists who are still working were starting their careers, you know, 40, 50 years ago. we didn't have what we have now. So they learned to do what they do using animals. And, you know, to reach this point, to reach that, you know, 40 to 50 years of your career and admit that what you've been doing is either a sham or a mistake, that would take a lot of guts, and not a lot of people are going to do that or be able to do that or even admit it to themselves. So you're really motivated to keep doing the same thing, and these people are training their students to do those experiments because that's what they know. You've set up your laboratories to do animal experiments, so even if you have a change of heart, even if you're an early career researcher, reinvesting that money to stop what you're doing, to buy new equipment, to get training, all that time, you know, you don't really have a way to support yourself and your graduate students. So, you know, even if you've had a realization that you want to switch to a different type of methodology, there's a big upfront cost to that and not a lot of incentive to do that. And then, you know, some people, they just convince themselves that what they're doing is right, or that, you know, animals are different than other animals are different than humans, and don't, you know, we have the allowance to do what we want with them. So some, you know, that's just some people's basis for thinking. So I think those are some of the big reasons why these experiments are still happening after 30 years. I was honestly, even though I read about this stuff every day at PETA, I was still surprised that so many of them are still happening. So some examples of experiments that are still going on that shouldn't be. One that pops into my mind is mainly because it's an experiment that I work on a lot for PETA, is something called the forced swim test. And it's used, it was developed in between the 50s and the 70s for testing antidepressant drugs. And so you drop a mouse or a rat into a cylinder of water, and supposedly if they've been dosed with an antidepressant drug, they will swim for longer before they start to just float. And so this is supposed to predict if a substance is a good antidepressant. But it's been shown over and over and over again that it's not a good test, it's not reliable, doesn't model depression, which I think any common sense person could see just looking at the experiment. But papers are published every single day using the forced swim test still. And some of this is to do things like, there have been recent experiments, you know, looking at you know, nutritional components, so vitamins or herbs or things that you could give to a human volunteer that are safe for humans to ingest. You could ask them questions about mood. You could do longitudinal studies. You could study people that use these substances already. And you would learn a lot more about human mood and the effects of these substances on human mood doing that. Again, forced swim tests, every day we see new papers published. So a lot of them are just things that are being done to animals information that we can glean non-invasively from humans. Those are very commonplace in the literature when you would think that there's some mechanism to prevent you from doing something to an animal that you can measure in a human, but there's just not. Other examples would be non-human primates are used for brain neuroscience studies, which involves, you know, implanting electrodes and measuring activity in different parts of the brain in response to visual stimuli. And we can do that in humans using EEG, using brain imaging, using MRI. That can all be done in humans as well. And a lot of the toxicology tests, too, tests that are done that are necessary to be done to determine that things in our environment are safe for us, but there are so many non-animal alternatives for those now.
Getting into another health issue, one example that you've written about are the heart failure experiments on dogs that have been done for decades that are still going on, and these especially hideous experiments are currently being done at the University of Utah, Northwestern University, Wayne State University, and I'm sure many other institutions. Can you describe these heart experiments and why they're so cruel for the dogs? And why, this is my big question, why after decades of heart experiments on dogs, is heart disease still the number one killer in humans? Why haven't we found a cure yet, as scientists claim they are trying to do?
the heart failure experiments are just horrendous. And I think one thing that makes them especially awful in my mind is that they're using, I mean, it would be bad either way, but I think they're not using necessarily dogs who are bred for research, which is one horrible thing that happens. You know, dogs are bred in these terrible facilities like Envigo, which was just shut down in Virginia. But the dogs that are being used in these studies are often dogs that are just gotten from a local animal shelter before they're euthanized. So these could have been someone's companion. In the experiments, in all of the cases that we mentioned in the afterword, in general, the researchers implant electrodes onto the dog's heart and force them, you know, through electrical stimulation to beat in a certain rhythm, or force the atria to contract every 4 seconds, or the ventricles. And this happens, you know, in some cases, every 4 seconds, their heart is being stimulated for almost 2 years. So you can imagine, I mean, just anyone can imagine if your heart is being made to beat, you know, if you've ever had your heart flutter or something like that, it's kind of a scary feeling. And that's happening constantly for years at a time. And they do this to try to induce heart failure and in attempts to study what's happening to the hearts on a specific level. Each experiment is given about $600,000 annually from the NIH, and these are for many years at a time. I think a big reason that, you know, we haven't been able to knock cardiovascular disease down from its number one spot, I mean, these experiments are kind of just a subset of cardiovascular experiments. But a big problem is, you know, when people are having heart failure, they're not having it because a pacemaker has artificially controlled when their ventricles or their atria contract for years at a time. They have an underlying disease, and that's what's contributing to their heart rhythm differences. And so just that fact alone, you know, it makes the studies really incomparable. Another reason is, you know, dogs are used because, you know, well, for one reason, they're easy to get or easy to breed or docile to use, but for another reason, their hearts are larger, obviously, than a rat's or a mouse's, so they can be easier for the researchers to study. And yes, dogs have a four-chambered heart, just like we have a four-chambered heart, but that's not really what we're studying in medicine anymore. You know, the treatments that are being developed these days are looking at very minuscule, very micro elements of physiology. The genes, the molecules that regulate genes, the specific proteins that, you know, in the contraction process. And those are where humans and other animals are different, where we're trying to develop therapeutics in those very micro levels. And so that's another reason why these experiments aren't translating.
I have a personal fascination with the new non-animal human-specific tools in biotechnology, and I'm not a scientist, and I honestly don't understand half of what I'm reading when I read about these tools, but I'm still fascinated by it and how they can do a better, more precise job than animals in advancing human health. Could you briefly describe maybe just a couple of these tools to those of us who may not be scientists, such as organs on a chip, for example?
Yeah, those are super exciting, and you hear about it, and it, like, if you hadn't seen one or seen all the presentations, your brain would be like, what does that even mean, organ on a chip? But they're super cool. They are, so most people know what a Petri dish looks like, and so a lot of the more the older traditional ways that scientists studied things, what we call in vitro, which means in a dish, not in a living organism, were using, you know, Petri dishes, and they'd look at human cells on a Petri dish and how they interacted with different substances or different cells. But oftentimes, because, you know, the human body is obviously not two-dimensional, we're three-dimensional, and we have various pressures and forces and different organs that cause our cells to react in certain ways, those, you know, just very simple Petri dish experiments don't always translate either, even though you're using, you know, human tissues. So organs on a chip are one way to make that better. And so these are small devices. They're about the size of a computer memory stick, and they have different channels. And so instead of putting those cells on a flat dish, you're putting them in these three-dimensional channels and you're applying different forces. I was in a presentation with one company that makes these organs on chips called Emulate, and they were showing two slides, and one was like a cross-section of a human intestine, and this was taken like from a biopsy sample from a patient, and they had a histologist look at that picture of the cells, and then they had a histologist look at a picture, a cross-section of human intestinal cells grown on a human intestine on a chip, and he could not tell the difference between them. There are a lot of them now, and it's almost hard to keep track of what all they're being used for. One of the first ones was they created a part of a human lung on a chip. And because you can apply pressures, they were able to make the cells expand and contract by pushing and pulling the little device to create like a respiration. And so they're able to use those to study the effect of inhaled substances like cigarette smoke or vape devices or things like that, or other respiratory diseases or respiratory viruses. Then they're being used by a lot of pharmaceutical companies now. For example, there was a study a couple years ago where the pharma company AstraZeneca wanted to test a drug that they had released, and it had to be called off the market because it caused blood clots in humans, and those blood clots weren't predicted by the animal tests. But they tested this in an organ on a chip, a human organ on a chip, and they found that they saw blood clots there. So these, every day we're seeing more publications showing that these methods are better predict what you see in humans. Another in vitro method involves organoids. So these are also three-dimensional ways to grow human cells using different scaffolding techniques or ways to make them, like, for example, our brain obviously isn't a flat disc. It's a three-dimensional structure, so you can grow parts of the brain in three dimensions, which really, you see the different foldings and the layers of the brain. So those are two in vitro methods. There's also, we have really advanced computers these days and even artificial intelligence, so human biological systems can be modeled with computer modeling, even using AI to create predictions about sense patterns that, humans, as smart as we are, can't sense. So using that as a method, and then our ways to image, especially the human brain or other human tissues, has gotten very advanced as well. So those are all different things that can replace a lot of the animal experiments. And the fact that they're grounded in human biology is the key. As I mentioned, those very micro levels are where we are the most different from other animals. So some of these organs on chips and organoids can be made using a patient's own cells. Like, so you have a patient with a specific genetic mutation, you can collect cells non-invasively, even just a scraping, like a skin cells, and use them to reprogram them and create specific devices where you're really, developing personalized medicine for that patient.
Even with these awesome tools, there's still a great degree of inertia among the scientific community about accepting these new technologies. Evolving with the times seems natural to me, but that isn't the case when it comes to animal experimentation. And you touched upon why: money, tradition, all of that. So PETA has a new strategy to get the ball rolling called the Research Modernization Deal. Can you describe this plan and what listeners can do to help?
Yes, thank you. The Research Modernization Deal is the first comprehensive plan to phase out all animal experimentation. So there's a lot of lip service paid by governments and regulatory agencies that say, we support transitioning away from animal experiments where possible, but no real actual plan on how to get there. So the Research Modernization Deal is that. It covers both disease area and curiosity-based experiments, as well as regulatory testing, so testing products and testing for toxicity and medications. And it has 5, soon to be 6 steps, because we're issuing a new version later this year. But the 5 steps are really common sense. So the first one is to immediately stop using animals in disease areas where we know they're poor models of humans. And these are areas where the failure of drugs in those areas, the failure of new drugs, is between 95 and 100%. There's not a lot that can fail. Like, if something fails 95% of the time, 99% of the time, we usually don't keep doing it, but that's not true for animal experiments, unfortunately. So the first step is to really just, the worst areas of translation, the worst models, just stop funding those. The second step is to shift funding, to increase funds for the non-animal methods, the kinds we discussed, and for preventative healthcare, preventative research, things like that. So shift funding away from animals and prioritize research that uses non-animal methods. Because the scientists are going to follow the money. If they know there's more funding for those methods, they're going to go that route. The third step is to conduct, for those areas that aren't as clear to the scientific community if animal models are useful or not, the research modernization deal says, okay, we'll do a really rigorous, systematic review of the use of animals in those areas to determine if they're useful. Because that's not even done. You know, these experiments keep getting funded based on the researchers, just saying, yes, this is a good model, without anybody actually, doing any analysis to see if that's right. The fourth step is to implement an ethical harm-benefit analysis system. This is something that exists in other countries, like in the EU, in the UK. It's not required here to weigh the harms to animals against a potential benefit to humans. So it proposes to add that in. That would definitely eliminate a lot of the most harmful experiments from being done, because there's no way they could outweigh the benefit, the very little to no benefit. And then the final step involves regulatory testing for toxicity, and just says, we should harmonize with other countries, because there are non-animal test methods that may be accepted in other countries that aren't yet accepted here, or vice versa. So that should be harmonized globally to where we're all using, the best methods. The step that we're adding involves specifically training researchers, providing specialized training grants to researchers and regulators to learn about non-animal methods and even how to use them, so that to provide that missing link.
Something you wrote in your afterword in the book Free the Animals jumped out at me. You wrote, "Although I cannot say that this is true for everyone in the animal experimentation community, I know that there are those like me and the scientists I have worked with who are good people caught in a corrupt industry that must be forced to change. Can you expand on that thought?"
Yeah. I spent 4 years in a PhD program, and I worked with a lot of people there that are, good people, and they're trying to do good science. And, what they're doing is based on that historical inertia of the animal experiments that have come before, or they feel like, well, this is what I've been trained to do. This is my livelihood. They're not bad people, even though they're doing horrible things to animals. I did horrible things to animals, and that was a bad thing that I did, but I don't think I'm a bad person. But so that's why I really think what has to change in science for, so many reasons, not just for ending animal experimentation, but a lot of the problems that exist within academia and science as a whole, is the incentive system, being pushed to just generate papers, get grants, not really, given a lot of leeway to learn new techniques or, switch methods or do better science, just being judged on those metrics alone. It just creates a very bad atmosphere. So the people who are working at the federal agencies who decide what experiments are going to be funded and what are not are often, you know, older people who learned science when there weren't a lot of better methods. Making that shift mandatory where, you know, you have, if there's a non-animal way to do an experiment, that has to get priority for funding over the animal-based method. Forcing those changes to happen based on where the money goes or based on what's encouraged of researchers and how we judge their productivity, that, you know, that's what really could change the lives of a lot of people and animals too.
To learn more about the research modernization deal, you can go directly to PETA.org/New Deal, where you can read the latest report. Or take action. For residents of the U.S., PETA has an online form where you can contact your members of Congress to let them know you support this plan. And if you're not in the U.S., PETA also has the Research Modernization Deal for India, the EU, and soon to be for the UK, France, and Germany. Thanks for listening to Dog Research Exposed. Check out our website at www.dogresearchexposed.com for more resources and actions you can take to help dogs in research laboratories today.